All right, hello. Thank you very much for coming. This is Virtual Gets Physical, the Future of Installations. I know it's the last session of the day and it's a little bit late, so I really appreciate your coming. This is Virtual Gets Physical. So as you can see, we have a hashtag set up, SX installs. I'll try to monitor that on my iPad as Wi-Fi allows. And in preparation for this, as the four of us have been meeting for the last couple months, we set up a Tumblr with a lot of the videos that we may or may not be referencing, but I think it's a really good collection of things within the field that we find really impressive and noteworthy. So it's mobile-enabled in a way, so if we get boring, please look down at your iPads and check out some videos, but remember to turn the sound off. For those of you playing along with the drinking game that we're starting up here, if anyone on the panel says Minority Report or Steve Jobs or Holodeck,
meow,
that is the cue to drink.
Or RFID.
You know, because it's late, we want to keep this a little bit looser. This is a panel, but we want to keep it in a fairly open format, like round table. So I'm encouraging them to argue with each other and bait each
Punch.
Other. And I would like the audience to help us along with that as well. So if anywhere along the line you have a question that you would like to ask, please step up to the microphone and catch our attention, and we'll turn to you. Otherwise, I will try to save a good 10 or 15 minutes at the end for questions. So on the subject of Virtual Gets Physical, we've got a basic outline of some of the high-level things we want to mention and start conversation with. Of course, we'll start with some introductions for the three panelists. I will do 35 seconds on how we got from 1980 to 2011, and then we're going to talk about the term experiential and the environments where digital is most apt to go and become an experience. We're going to hit on space and the influence of space on those digital experiences. Input, you know, touch and gesture and some of the more futuristic inputs that sort of drive you through the experiences. Nonlinear storytelling, which is sort of arises when you start to put a lot of digital executions into large spaces. And then we'll wrap up with like the conversation of future tech and exactly how long we have to wait for our holodeck to be created.
Shot.
Right, sorry.
All right, so let's start with introductions. I should apologize. I am not Tali Krakowski. She was going to be the moderator, but at the very last minute had to pull out for personal reasons. She really wanted to be here. She sends her regrets to anyone who came to see her. I will do my absolute best to work in her stead. But my name is Saren Sakurai. I work for Juxt Interactive in Newport Beach. And then, gentlemen, maybe each of you can tell us who you are, where you're from, and sort of where you are unique within the experiential landscape. Thomas, do you want to start?
Sure. My name is Thomas Wester. I'm technology director at Second Story. Been doing that for 9 years. Second Story does a lot of digital experiences for museums and educational institutions, but also more and more we're finding ourselves doing themed entertainment. I'm coming from a pretty technical background, being a developer and then moving into managing developers and also really selecting the technologies that we want to use in spaces.
How you doing? My name is Jeff Whitney. I'm a creative director at Juxt Interactive. We're in Newport Beach, as Saren said, Southern California. We work under George P. Johnson and Project Worldwide and doing a lot of experiential design and experiences in the trade show space and auto show environment. Most recently, we've done a lot of work on the Toyota and Scion accounts as well as Honda, and you know, pushing the ball up the middle on how people can really interact when they come to these trade shows and auto shows to really engage and interact with the product and learn about the product. So I'm going to be coming from how you can utilize or leverage digital experience and storytelling to dimensionalize the product when you come to these types of events or live engagements and events of such. So,
my name is Mike Kern. I'm with We Like Small, and we're out of beautiful Salt Lake City. That escapes everyone there. Our specialty is digital consultancy. I'm our creative director, and essentially what we do is any variety of things for the web or having to do with digital, and everything from websites to iPad apps to big digital experiences. And really what we kind of specialize in is what I would say is tough digital problems and trying to figure out creative solutions to it and merge technology into those.
Great. So we do want to talk about the future, but we should spend a second or two in the past on the way to the present. I think in terms of experiences and digital, you know, for the people who are in this room, it really sort of, and for the masses who are the audiences who are sort of taking all of this in, you know, the 80s were a really good starting point for the masses to sort of engage with purely digital experiences. And in the 80s, I think we're talking about the early console games, like Atari, ColecoVision, where, you know, from my experience, I was 12 or 13, and, you know, you could sort of put your entire world into that monochrome screen and exert a lot of effort onto a joystick that was pretty tactile. From there, in the 90s, you know, the explosion of the WWW, you know, and websites replacing 800 numbers as marketing tools, and the browser wars, you know, experiences sort of were interconnections between text and pictures. It started out, you know, very simplistic, but fairly quickly it got pretty robust. And I think also in the 90s, a lot of us may have started our careers working for a CD-ROM company, where, you know, you're led through a story, you know, with a little bit of variety of turning left and right, but not a ton. In the aughts, bigger bandwidth brought, you know, really great, big, experiential flash websites. You know, Nike spent a lot of time and effort on some really rich experiences that would last 15 minutes. And full-screen video sort of hit the scene. You could tell a longer story on a web, and which led to a lot of the Netflix of today. So power books and home theaters. And the introduction of mobile phone was really big. So right now in the teens, or coming up on the teens, it's a lot about convergence. It's a lot about all the trends that were started in those decades that coming together, the you know, the heavy bandwidth, the thirst for digital, and finding ways to advance storytelling beyond, you know, the linear model. And so everyone up here is sort of has in common that they're thinking through either the problems or the stories for their clients that come through in an execution that we call experiential. So I thought we'd start it off with sort of a discussion about what does that really mean? What sort of environments or what sort of conditions are perfect for to bring digital into the physical realm? Jeff, you want to start with?
Yeah, I can start. So again, I'm coming from the trade show, auto show sector, and you know, this is anywhere from auto shows, boat shows, product shows specifically. And I'm only going to talk about my experience and kind of shape my point of view up in regards to the projects that I've worked on. Traditionally at these shows, you have to understand people come. We all know that we come to shows to touch and feel the product. It is really all about the product. People want to come to the auto shows to literally sit inside a car, wrap their fingers around the leather steering wheel, feel the seats, maybe get to know the brand that they're considering. Whether they're considering buying or not, they could just be in killing a Sunday afternoon, taking the family out. There's moms with strollers pushing through these spaces. So you're really talking to everybody, every type of consumer, old and young, and again, in-market shoppers and not. Traditionally we would go into these spaces when it comes talks about, you know, specific space design and the experience itself. You'd slap up some graphic design and maybe you'd have some beautiful architecture surrounding the vehicles or the boats or the products, and that would be it. You might have some pretty girls to tell you about it, right? So in regards to digital, what we're seeing is that, you know, obviously we need to dimensionalize those products a bit more, and you can get a lot more of a brand story through content and discovery in digital surfaces, digital spaces, about the product. You can get to know, and there's the opportunity to connect with these people beyond just a pencil and a paper. Whenever they're on these show floors. Likewise, again, don't think of the trade shows as just being in the traditional trade show sense. This is you know, where there's product or live events outside under tents in the sunlight. People just want to engage with the brand in a certain way. So,
well, on top of that, it's a pretty competitive environment, right?
Completely.
Like loud, and everyone's shouting and screaming and throwing things at you. So
right.
If you can put a little intimacy into you and some sort of information or entertainment,
right?
Like you kept them there for a little bit longer, probably giving them a little bit better experience.
Yeah, I mean, you have to realize whatever you, however you engage your customer, the point is that you give them a delightful experience in the space, and yeah, try to keep them there as long as possible, because if they're not in your space for your brand, exploring your products and your stories, and they're across the aisle at the other one. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think we actually, I'm just going to talk a little bit about a recent project we did with American Express, and I'm going to try not to talk too much about anything that any. I think we all kind of made a conscious decision not to talk too much about our own projects when we came into this, but I wanted to bring up that one thing that we've seen is in the course of creating these projects is that most consumers aren't necessarily comfortable in these spaces sometimes. They're walking into this, they're usually there for another event, and I think that that plays directly into how much they engage with the space. So in your auto experience, basically, how do you guys draw people in? What's been the most effective? How about that?
The most effective. I mean, media definitely plays a huge role. Video and media design specifically. That's not what's pulling people into the space. What's pulling people into the space really is the product itself. You're enhancing that space through digital means, and it's really kind of that 20-foot experience through sight and sound that you could attract people in.
So yeah, in our experience, we kind of had a similar experience. We built a big installation piece for the U.S. Open for tennis, and it was funny because we keep thinking about there was a very intellectual side to this, a very tool-building side to it, where you could go through the experience and see what was going on at the event at any given time. But the most successful piece in the end was like a 500-foot LED display that everyone could walk into and see. So it's sometimes we think about these digital problems and we think they're particularly complex, but sometimes the most obvious things, like a big flashing banner, is actually what draws people into the space, and then you have to kind of get the engagement out of them.
Yeah, I think that what's really worked for us well is not necessarily focusing on the technology or the format, but really trying to figure out what the story is. So what are you trying to, what's your content? And then if you can find an experience that uses that well, or that has a good narrative to it, to the space, and it is local to that space, then that's effective. So it's not like, oh, you know, surface tables are effective or Kinect is effective. It's like it's only effective if it fits with what you're trying to say. And I think a lot of the challenge is working with clients to understand what they're trying to say. Often they don't know.
Yeah, some of the times it's digital can be an alternative to a live individual, so like a curator. But I mean, in retail or in trade shows, like people are a little bit hesitant to go up and engage with a human being because they kind of know that they're trying to go for their email and address. And so like a little iPad is a little bit something that, you know, they're used to doing their research digitally, but they can get all the information they need without having to talk to anybody. Well, I mean, tell me a little bit more about space in particular. Like, so the U.S. Open, that's outdoors. Like,
right, so we actually had, in our scenario, we had a large tent, and what we found was that we had two of these experiences that we built. One of them, you can kind of see in that picture there, we had a different one than that one. We had flat screens, like a big long wall. You could interact with these screens, and we found that it worked, but most of the time, people wanted like actual person-to-person interaction. So when the spaces were built for U.S. Open for tennis, we actually built these round spaces to accommodate people standing around, gathering around them, and someone in the center to guide them through that process. And we found, at least for what we were creating, personal connection was extremely important to your space. It's really, really intimidating, I think, for most people, and especially a non-millennial generation, if I were to say, to engage with these spaces. They feel really self-conscious and really intimidated to actually go up and touch. And I think when we were all talking the other day, we had one common theme that we always see is that children are the first ones to engage. They're like the first ones to go up there and touch and play and actually want to experience this thing because they just have no self-consciousness to it. And I kind of equate it to video chatting almost. I have these video chats with my kids all the time, and I think, you know, it's a very natural thing. When I talk to my wife, it's a little bit different. It's a little odd, I think, because there's like this self-consciousness that goes to it. And I think the same holds true for interactive spaces. We really need to when we think about the spaces, think of ways to like get person-to-person contact to help them engage with the space, and then from there actually, you know, let them go.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the thing with space is really it adds a whole new layer of ingredients or a whole batch of ingredients that you can start playing with. When you're coming from a digital realm, it's very, my experience has been very easy to think of, oh, you know, let's just put a touchscreen in there and then that's going to be it. And then I'm going to focus on everything that's inside that touchscreen. And you're not looking at where that touchscreen is and you're not looking at how it relates to the space you're in. You're not talking to the architect or you're not talking to the fabricators. And I think that the more successful experiences are holistic experiences where you are working, you either have that kind of skill set in-house or you build a good relationship with a partner that can help you out with that and can give you much more visibility to that. So, again, I guess a common theme of thing what I'm saying is that the technology is something that should serve the content. It should serve the story you're trying to tell. Your focus should be on, you know, what's the right thing to do here.
Yeah, and I mean, once you move off of the screen as the sole focal point, you can engage all sorts of other senses, right? Like there's sound and height, and like you can, you know, you really can alter the space to serve the story in the best possible way.
When I want to tell you about spaces and how things are changing now, specifically the we don't just fill holes with technology, right? And we really have to have a plan. You know, we have to think about our clients' wishes and what they want to accomplish. We don't just have a box to fill up things with. You really have to have a strategy on how you want your customer to move through the space and move through the environments, whether it's the VIP tent and at the U.S. Open or museum space, right? I mean, there's really... it's not just holes in drywall and like you said, stick a touchscreen in there. Traditionally, you know, that stuff used to be pushed to the very back of the presentations and the kind of the product presentations when we're talking about these auto shows specifically. They were pushed to the back for a reason. One, people were kind of scared of them. They weren't quite, you know, didn't quite know how they worked or how to fix them if they crashed. And being towards the back of these booths and the backs of these exhibits, if they crashed, which 9 times out of 10 they do anyway, right? Then they could just be out of the way. But now, you know, moving into the future, that stuff is actually being pulled out as a premier part of the space experience when you move through the space. And so that stuff has to be designed with all that in mind that your customer is actually almost expecting it. Expecting a technology experience, and I've actually seen people touch just passive video screens and kind of pissed off because they aren't touch screen and just walk away, you know?
I've got a good story about that, actually. I just recently bought a new TV, and I installed the TV. I knew full well this was not a touchscreen TV. I was dumb enough while I was actually installing it I needed to adjust the brightness, and I was dumb enough to actually try and touch the screen. I knew perfectly well it wasn't a touch screen. I just wanted to see if it worked.
Can I ask,
you brought up this point of failure, I guess, in a little bit. You know, like, these digital experiences failed. And Second Story's been probably doing interactive installation work for longer than any of us have. Mm-hmm. And I'm really curious what you guys have had in, from a museum standpoint, what have you, in the past, I guess... failed at and actually learned from?
I think that what we failed at is what I was saying earlier, is to focus on the technology only, to focus on the, not the technology, but the device that you're using, and not to think of it in a larger context. And so that's something that, if you look at the arc of our projects, part of it's technical, like the cost of technology has come down so that now we could do large walls. So previously, if, like in 2004, you could like, oh yeah, we need a large wall. We'd be like, yeah, that's never going to happen because it's too expensive. And I think part of the story that we're doing is, or that we're on, or journey, whatever to call it, is that technology has come down in price, that there's a lot of more opportunities. But I think that that's really the biggest, and when I see installations that don't work, or they only have a wow factor, but they don't have a follow through, so it's like, it's only wow, and then there's nothing there there. People aren't going to come back to that. So that's where I was going with that. I think that another thing about space is you have to embrace the group dynamics of it. So when you build a website, it's going to be one person using that website. So if you're coming from digital, or even if you're building an app, typically it's one person using that app, even though you know they're part of Facebook virtual community stuff. In space, people typically go with their buddy or they're with their family there. And you have to design experiences that allow for more people to join. Like one of the ones that's up there is it's a big moon table, and the idea is that three or four people can sit behind it, and you can look at it. What you find is that different generations of parents are there with their kids, that the kids, they will typically come up and they'll start asking their parents questions, and then they're like, oh, okay, you know, and that's how that, and it starts rolling really easily. But if you don't design your physical environment, if you don't design your thing for that to be comfortable, or for two people to be comfortable sitting next to it, or, you know, if you're just not thinking about it that way, then you're missing a critical thing. I think people really, especially kids, they just gather around and start touching stuff.
On the subject of touch,
I was just going to say a failure that we learned quickly in the trade show space. Whenever you actually any space for that matter, I mentioned light, even daylight, even overhead lights. Don't take that for granted. It may be beautiful in your studio and you're testing and you're geeking out on how rad it looks, but once it gets under the floodlights, there's a whole other story that you got to deal with. Yeah. You know, your designers may spend hours, you know, pushing pixels ever so slightly to make it perfect, and then when they don't show up, that's a problem. So when you're dealing with touchscreens specifically, and I know, you know, technology is changing so rapidly, but touchscreens specifically, when you have these IR overlays, they deal with light, and the floor lighting is definitely a problem. So that has to be taken into consideration. Not only the experience lighting, but the technology itself can be hindered. So,
well, let's talk more specifically about like touch versus gesture. You know, like I think over the last 2 years, maybe, you know, things have gone from. I mean, well, Apple sort of set the standard, right? They introduced you know, consumers to touch, and you know, because of their position in the world and the market, like, they are basically dictating, you know, the interface of touch. So, like, we're not necessarily working on that platform every single time. So what are sort of the common themes that arise out of, you know, starting to install touch more and more into retail spaces or any of these spaces?
I think that Apple has set the expectation of certain pinch zoom and stuff like that, but I think that they are really not present as strongly in building physical experiences like we do. So I disagree with the fact that they set the tone. I mean, they set the tone in the sense that, yes, everybody expects to touch devices now, and they've done a great job at that. Mm-hmm. But that is just an entry level into what you can do with it. You can do, again, I'm going to come back to this idea of a group experience and thinking about how do a group of people or two or three people use this experience, or how can I use this physical space and digital technology to get people to talk? I mean, that's another thing, is that we're all looking at our screens, but space is really relevant to us, and our brains are like programmed to think spatially. And I think there's a big thing there. If you can bring digital, you bring digital into that into a physical world, you can start making that match. Hmm.
I may be wrong, and I want somebody to correct me if I am, so you can stand up and say I'm wrong. But Apple is very much influencing how we interact with these screens, just by the sheer numbers alone, and the people that are getting, you know, finally they get their very own little touchscreens, whether it's a smartphone, an iPhone, or a tablet in form of the iPad. The sales numbers are staggering, right? when it comes to how we interact. Yes, the pinch to zoom, and it's kind of the standard, and Apple's setting the standard on how people expect things to react. And you've got the crazy designers going off and designing these interfaces and different gestures because they think it's kind of cool and let's try something different. But you have to understand whatever you're designing, there's kind of these standards. Something very simple as touching, single touch to close. The average person is double tapping to close, whether you like it or not. We designed a specific experience that when you activated a piece of content and it came up, you know, the kind of in the traditional web sense and my background, it was really, well, put a close button on it, right? And in the right top right corner, the little X button. Everybody knows how to close something. And we didn't realize until, you know, the project launched and we saw people engaging with it, is people didn't really see that close button. They were double tapping to close it. And then they got frustrated and just walked away, you know, and getting kind of lost. But we made that.
Do you guys make things twice the size too?
Yeah, you got to be big. You got to be obvious. But anyway, so when it comes to how people are engaging with touch, you just have to keep in mind that there's these certain standards and trends, and that it's kind of ingrained in us. There's a reason for that. So
I think also a thing that we found is that the touch resolution that people expect from using iPads and using iPhones doesn't scale. The technology isn't there yet that actually that same touch resolution, that you can get that on any table. So what you expect works really well on an iPad is not necessarily going to work really well on 55-inch multi or 70-inch multi-touch screen. And you have to be, you really have to do a lot of prototyping and get the thing in, and light, like the latest Surface is very sensitive to light. So if you put it in a bright space, it's just not going to work. So, I mean, stuff like that's a big deal. If you don't get one into your studio and actually start dealing with it and start putting content on it as quickly as you can, I think that that's a big thing, is to be physically prototyping and building stuff as soon as you can with the hardware that you envision you're going to use.
So, I mean, I think, you know, the touch has been, you know, spreading like wildfire, like in trade shows and in retail. Like, do you think that the audience is sort of adapted to that now, and like it's fine, and, like that's not going to scare them in a year from now, or... Or is it still on the too far ahead of the curve?
I think people are still scared, period, to engage in things in the real world or physical space. They're safe. They're safe with their little iPads in front of them. But if you give them the opportunity to walk up and touch something or touch a wall or touch a screen, especially, we were talking about kids. I know, Mike, you were like, of course, kids run up and they'll just beat on it and touch it and they have no fear. But the majority of people are still a little bit scared. It's stage fright, you know. And we'll touch on this a little.
Yeah, I invite everyone, if you want to see probably one of the most embarrassing things of all time, look up Kinect and World of Warcraft. I forget the exact college that actually did this as an experiment, but you know, they basically hooked a Kinect up to World of Warcraft, and the guy's just kind of marching away through the land and waving his invisible sword, and it's probably the most ridiculous thing you've ever seen in your life. And that makes me look at that and say, you know, maybe just me thinking that, someone who's immersed in digital every day, probably say, you know, maybe we're not ready for it, but maybe the next generation is. So it could take longer than a year or 2 years. It could be 10, 15 years till we get over this stigma.
I think that there's a thing with touch, and again, you can focus on touch and you say, oh, people don't want to touch. They don't feel comfortable touching. But if the payoff, and if you can build the experience in such a way that through touching they're actually changing the space they're in, or they're able to contribute to the space they're in, so that there's this dialogue that starts happening between them using the interface and stuff happening. So examples of that is, if you do have a wall, or if you have large projections, stuff that you're doing on the screens can affect what happens on the large projections. Stuff like that, we found that people, if it's in a playful manner and you're able to convey that this is what they're doing and there's going to be a feedback loop that's going to be fun for them, then they're happy to do it. It's just when it's just a kiosk and that's all it is, and they have to step up and it's awkward and they don't know what they're going to expect, then people don't want to use it.
Yeah. What do you guys think about thought? Like, just thought control on... No, I mean, and seriously, there have been a number of projects in our industry lately that have been, like, you know, B-Real did a big thought piece where where you actually can control the scale electrics cars through your mind. There have been a number of kind of little examples like this. I was at a New Year's Eve party the other week quite a few weeks ago now, where basically, you know, like the kids were sitting here playing like, oh, let's get the ball to the other side. And it was just you think and you do mathematical problems, you do whatever you can. And I think I wonder how that's going to actually play into what we do, because it becomes transparent, right? It's this idea of like an invisible interface. We stop touching, we stop moving, we stop gesturing, we just think, and nobody can see that. It's not embarrassing. I don't know.
I find it fascinating personally, yes. I think as a creative, I think, yeah, I want to play with that. I want to build something, right? But I don't think thought control is quite practical for the average person, but we all want to build something.
Well,
like
I think the relevance of thought control, I mean, it speaks to the ability to sense people in spaces and to sense what they're feeling or to sense where they're at, and to contextualize the information for them. And I think that's what space does well. I don't know if thought is the right medium to do that with, because I think it's more of a controlling thing, like you can control something with your thoughts, but how would I can't even think about how you would really do something with that.
How about it's an interesting idea.
Next year.
How about if you can use thought tracking to build your metric story, so you can really judge, you know, brand intent by reading people's thoughts, and they don't have to sign up anything. You know, that'd be cool in a space.
That sounds scary.
I mean, it's serious. Once you get beyond touch and gesture, and you start and voice, when you go into face recognition or these really subtle things about human beings, like, you're going to have to answer some security question issues, because, like, you know, they may be scared to go up and touch something, but once they feel like they know you know who they are and what they're thinking, like, yeah, you can face some pretty...
We can't go from touch to thought. Let's talk about gesture.
Come on, I'm just being devil's advocate here.
Well, okay, so
let's talk about gesture, you know, like...
Yeah, well, on the way to thought, gesture is just the thing that we've noticed come very, you know, into these public spaces. It's starting to sort of get a little bit widespread. I mean, the Kinect is the second most widely or quickly to a million people installs or something like. It's just almost as popular as iPhone in a way. Like, is that something that people are more easily adapted to? Is it really more? You know, would people rather sort of just stand in a space and move their body rather than having to walk into particular places? Like, what's the...
We've been finding that the Kinect has been interesting to sense, to know where somebody's in space and have space react to them. But actually, as an input device, it's pretty poor. People feel like they're a fool. Mm. The skeletal tracking isn't good enough in the physical space, which again is group based. And you have to like say, oh, stand in this square, and then, you know, I'm going to track you. It doesn't work. For games, I think it might work, and very specific applications. I'm not saying it's stupid, but it's in the stuff that we've been doing, we've been having a hard time getting beyond visualizing people in 3D or scanning people in 3D and kind of using this, you know, this new level of data that you're getting from the space. We're used to have webcams, now you have the depth that comes with the webcam. So there's a lot of visual, interesting things that you can play with, but it's more from a creative perspective than it is really from we're going to use this as an input device.
Like somewhere in here is, you know, you guys can try to control your environment and the digital that's within it as well as you can. But like an example of like retail, let's say, the environment's fairly well set, and then people are bringing digital into the stores with them. So like smartphones, other stuff. Like what are the considerations you have to take into place when you can't really control your environment that much? Like, can you provide, you know, really engaging experiences through somebody's phone that they brought into the retail space or to the show space?
We just did a project with the High Museum in Atlanta, and what we did for them was we made a mobile app for exhibits that you can go through, and we wanted to get beyond the idea of it just being like, you know, tap the number and hear the story type of thing. And so we were able to use what people like doing in museums is they want to take pictures of stuff. And so the app that we have, they take a picture of something, and then actually it recognizes what they took a picture of, and then it gives them metadata, and they're able to share it, stuff like that. So you could say that was a successful application, but there's a lot of apps that don't have that aspect to them, and so I think it only works, and High Museum worked really well. People really responded to it because it has this meta story of what do you do in the museum, and what are you doing in this space, and what would you like to do in this space, and that works. I haven't done much retail, so I don't know, but I kind of draw blanks when I start thinking about what I do. in retail if it's just focused on the mobile device. I think if it has a larger thing, a larger campaign around it, or a larger reason to exist, it makes sense. But otherwise, I don't.
Yeah, people aren't
somebody prove me wrong, but
predisposed to download something special, right?
That's the thing. Yeah, are you really going to do that? I don't. I wouldn't. Yeah.
I'm kind of. I haven't tried the app, but I'm here in Austin now, and I'm kind of interested if anybody's tried that Violet Crowns app. That is a sound-based album based on your location around the city here. I think it's called Violet Crowns. Anybody?
We got one in the audience.
Anybody? One? Is it cool? Is it? I mean, I have it. I'm going to try it probably tonight. But
yeah, it's pretty
nice. Yeah, I mean, we're talking about light. We're talking about kind of digital engagement. But let's not forget about the power of sound and moving through the space. I think that's kind of an interesting way to connect. I mean, everybody has a, you know, not everybody has a smartphone, but people have these devices on them all the time. And there's interesting ways. Again, you have kind of that barrier as far as an app, but you're giving them an album, an experience in a real kind of space, in this case, a city. I think they did a version of it for in Central Park, I believe, yeah. Too, as well.
It seems a bit more befitting to a larger space.
Yeah, super cool. But I'm kind of fascinated with kind of the self-guided tour as well, you know?
Yeah.
That's kind of neat.
I think one thing is, I mean, this is input, but you see, and I've been to other panels today where it goes between input and sensing, and I think that that's a breakthrough that we're really getting into right now, is that it has been input for years. Technically, that's what's been affordable, but sensing has gotten so ubiquitous and so affordable that like a Kinect is $150 or $250, depends on which one you get, and that's just going to come down in price. That's not going to go up. That the ability for space to know who you are and where you're at, and those ideas, I know that there's a creepy aspect to that, but there's also a whole new layer of stuff that you can get involved in how you present the content and how you present the story to somebody.
Well, we actually, we had kind of a similar an experience with that just using RFID, and we essentially solved that problem by making the user as anonymous as possible, mm-hmm. and essentially utilizing just, you know, a tagging system, right? So it doesn't matter. You lose your piece. There's no critical data on that thing. There's nothing really personal about you. But yet you can use something like a chip in an environment where, you know, people come back to, and you can learn something from that, right? They can come there a number of times. You can sense where they are. I think if anybody went to the really crowded Bing tent, which was completely empty today when we walked by, they're using that there in a creative way. Whether I think it's the best usage of that technology or not is kind of beside the point, but they're using it in a really creative way where, hey, you know, you walk into this thing, we're going to upload some photos based on where you are in the event. I felt like that was a little too much for me, a little too creepy, but but I think there's abstract ways to do it. If you're trying to get data, if I go to a museum and then I come back to that museum and something as simple as, like, it helps me know which gallery pieces I've actually looked at before. You know, you go to a museum like the Met, that museum is so large, it's impossible to see, like, you know, more than a wing and really digest it. Right. It's a great way of tracking, like, where you've been without that factor of, oh, hey, I better not come back. You know, they know too much about me.
Right.
That's true. So we've gotten a little bit of talk about the spaces that these executions exist in. And we've talked a lot about some of the devices that we were using. Like, let's move to the next topic, which is storytelling, and particularly nonlinear storytelling. Like, that's something that we have the opportunity to sort of explore, probably ahead of a lot of other industries. And some of Second Story's work is innovating on that, because you are connected to some organizations that have, you know, a great depth of content.
Yeah.
Like, how do you starting to take space in these devices and tell stories under the conditions that we've sort of talked about so far?
Yeah, I think the easiest thing to explain, I guess, with nonlinear storytelling is that if you have a museum and you have 10 objects and you put them in the museum, but you actually have a collection of 3,000 objects, how can you teach them more about those objects? So you put your golden objects in there, and then they can go on their own exploratory experience, which is the nonlinear part. You have no control over where they're going to go. You have to provide just, you know, a storytelling framework for the content to go into. How does space deal with that? I think that space in itself, you talk to architects, they talk about the story of the space, and they talk, and I think that, that was my point saying earlier, that our brains are so accustomed to space. We make a lot of conclusions about the space we're in right now. It's like a fancy hotel, you know, like that type of stuff. So trying to find something that matches so that the digital experience that you're putting in, either it's purely digital, like what we did for the University of Oregon, it's a pretty empty...
In the middle.
That's the one in the middle. It's a pretty empty experience from a exhibit design perspective. It really is. It's all screens. And that's what we felt worked best for that space, because the idea is that it's a waterfall of content. And that's what a lot of that space is about. That so that it, it how does space influence it? The space influences it more likely in a failure mode, where what you think the story is not what the architect or the exhibit designer thought what the story was, and you weren't able to talk about it early enough in the project, and you're going to get, you know, pigeonholed into a certain solution that you're not necessarily happy with. We've gone into that a lot.
So it's the Alumni Center for the University of Oregon.
Yeah.
Like, so the story to be told is the history of the institution and all of the...
Well, there's two
students, right?
Yeah, there's two stories. One is the history of the institution, but the more relevant one is for prospective students what the school is and what it stands for. So they call it an alumni center because they got alums to pay for it. But sorry, I wasn't supposed to say that. Sorry. No, there's a main piece of that. But I'll track back from that so nobody comes after me. The idea is that if you use the current, what's happening right now in the University of Oregon, and we have content management tools, and the client can upload all this stuff, so everything you're seeing is dynamic, that people that used to go there feel more connected if it's actually dynamic content versus standard, like, video of just, you know, like, hey, rah-rah type of thing. So if they have the experience that they can go and search themselves, they can find where they were, or they can find where their kids are going, or they can understand what the current story of the... So that way you get two audiences at the same time.
Yeah. Well, what are the other components that make for non-linear, though? Like, it seems to me that, like... Mike, you were saying about how a lot of these spaces are going to have crowds in them. Therefore, you can't, it's not like a line. If you line people up to see, like, Mao's body, you know, they're all going to have the same experience, because it's, you know, it's pretty linear. And how you go in, you see him, you go out. If you got lots of digital in a confined space, like, and everyone's all over there, like, people are going to start their story and then drop it in the middle and move off to the side, or... And the next person is going to come up, and they're going to have to pretty quickly jump in somewhere, right? Or, I mean, what are the sort of opportunities that we have to sort of break that linear story mode and go into something a little bit more exploratory or engaging? Where are those?
Yeah, I think from my experience, it's been a tough call. I would definitely say that, like, that's one of the hardest things is that for me, it's been hard to come up with a plan and a plot for how to bring someone from A to B through an actual experience. I think what you have to do is you kind of... I guess we treat all of our work is almost like a tool-based thing, so we treat it like very much as, hey, tell us what you need to know, and then we'll show you what you didn't know you need to know, I guess, essentially. And I think we do... You know, there are really good exploratory experiences on the web, too, and there's great exploratory experiences in environments, but I think, I guess, yeah.
It's
a tough question. It's tough to, like, bring someone from that A to B point and just straight on through.
I think I'm going to use the idea of play and getting people to play with each other. That sounds odd. Ooh, it's a new idea. But the idea that people can engage with each other in different ways that they're not used to in space by visualizing where they are and having that have meaning. I think, like, you know, people can build virtual networks and stuff like that. I think that there's something that's pretty rich there when it comes to storytelling, nonlinear storytelling, is that people can make up their own stories that way.
I think simply nonlinear storytelling is if somebody steps in on a story, they can get the exact same experience and delight and positive experience with that story on page one just as much as if they were to step in on page 17. You know, if you think about it in a traditional book sense and storytelling, the linear storytelling. So really we're setting up these frameworks specifically for our stories and our platforms, and that story is told through bit-sized pieces of content, or I'm saying it can be, and I'm talking, you know, product specifically. You may set up an overall framework, an overall story, and I can reference the touch wall that we did with some great partners for Toyota in the Prius story. Is we set up, you know, three large touch screens, and that car kind of lived across all three, and each one of those screens held an environment. And anybody engaging in that story on any particular screen could expand that content and that story in relation to the car. They can learn about the factory process, you know, in the factory scene, or the product story, the attributes of the vehicle itself. If they were to engage it on the showroom story, and likewise an ownership story if they were to engage it on a third environment. But what we did was we allowed people to kind of dig through and pick and choose what they wanted to watch and what they wanted to kind of dig into at any moment in time, and then allow somebody to access from any screen any other part of the story. So they can actually switch the screen to page one if they'd like, or to the very end at any point. And that really gets to the collaborative effort. And then creating these delightful little discovery moments of across-screen collaboration, or kind of these little moments that happen when somebody, you know, engages or tosses something into the next screen. It's not something we told anybody to do, but you know, then you get a smile. That's what you definitely want.
I think another thing with just bringing content, digital content using digital means into a physical space, I guess is a way to say it, is that it becomes dynamic. You can now make it a dynamic space. So most spaces are by nature, they've been built and that's it. And by adding the digital aspect of it, you can make it updatable and it can change over time. If you look at traditional exhibit design, it doesn't change over time. That's it, 5 years, or it's going to be for 10 years, and that's it. If you go 10 years later, it's going to be exactly the same. But digital, and like a project like the University of Oregon, is going to change every year, every day. It has the potential to change. And I think that's a compelling thing. That touches on something that I've been seeing in the retail experience, where I've been into retail stores and also corporate briefing centers where you go in and it's all video, and they've gone through and they made them beautiful motion graphics, but that's it. And you can't do anything else because that's what they could conceive of at that point. I think a big challenge with putting digital in physical space that I've seen people struggle with is that you have to make the content. You're going to have to do something with it. You can't just put a screen in there and then have a looping video, you know, year in, year out. You're going to have to figure out a way to tell a story and to get your content, create content. I think for Second Story, it's a big deal for us because our stuff has to last for 5, 10 years. I think maybe in a trade show or retail location, it's not as important.
Well, I actually think
because it changes out quicker.
There's a really big kind of opportunity out there in digital retail itself, right? I mean, we have, you know, it starts with like kind of this digital price tagging thing, right? We've got these little price tag pieces, and you know, the grocery store can update your prices, but what if I take that example and I work that into something like Best Buy, right? I walk in, I've got an iPad there, and I can actually go through, tour a whole product that I'm there without having to talk to a salesperson necessarily, because I think retail itself, and we've done a lot and talked a lot about retail in our studio, retail itself kind of, you want to have a great experience with the product, but you don't necessarily want to be injected with like the used car salesman kind of pitch.
Right.
And so like we can do something like let's take all the idea of dynamic pricing, dynamic data sheets, dynamic, you know, whatever data about a particular product, inject that in there, keep it updating, and then also give someone the tour, a tour of that particular product. Mm.
Okay, so we're coming up with only 10 minutes left. So I'd like to invite the audience to start to come up for questions while I ask the final question of the panelists, which is sort of like, let's leave the present now. Let's go off into the wild beyond and see, like, what's the future of what we do? Like, what's coming that's going to get, are the new toys that we're going to get to play with, you know, in the short term, basically? Like,
Can I go? I got a list.
You go ahead.
I'm really excited. I think that a big thing, overarching thing with space and thinking about physicality of stuff is the maker movement and the idea of personal manufacturing, maker bots. This idea that it's kind of democratizing making stuff. You don't have to put $50,000 down just to make a single thing. You can just, you know, prototype your way through it, and then if you like it, you get somebody who's specialized to manufacturing it. I think that's a big deal. I think for digital, it's huge that we get to work with architects because they're really smart and engaging people. Just they think a lot similarly to the way that a lot of our creatives do. And it's we've seen, and I've seen this, I've enjoyed it as an engineer, but I've seen it with designers, that it really blows your brain to work with people like that. They're, the way that they think about things is different. And I also think locating people in space, which we've kind of talked about, the ability to contextualize a space to who's in there or how many people they're in there or what they're doing, I think is huge. And I think that from a novelty perspective, I think new displays, new volumetric displays, transparent displays, you're seeing Samsung and PepsiCo has it out here too. This idea of just, you know, ripping out the background, the guts of an LCD screen, just have the LCD screen stuff and then put a white, you know, some light behind it, it's pretty compelling. And I think that as we're moving forward, a lot of the stuff that was happening, I don't know, 100 years ago, that was dealing with film and photography and ways of visualizing things and were captivating people that way. An example is like the kaleidoscope. I don't know how old that is, but stuff like that. There's something in our brain that really is intrigued with these visualization. And if we can step out of just being a screen to having more depth screens or having just new different ways of visualizing stuff, I think that's a big deal. And I think that that's where the novelty, like if you need to do something that is wow, that's where that's going.
Hmm. Yeah, sure. I'll go next. You mentioned, I didn't have this on my initial list initially, but the transparent LCDs. There was a transparent installation at CES this year for LG that kind of blew my mind. Mm-hmm. It was kind of cool.
Yeah.
It was in the back, kind of in the home section of the LG booth, and they had these kind of four light boxes with transparent LCDs. Anybody saw them, they had products inside these light boxes and then actually visualized things with video over top of them. It was amazing. Each screen actually said touch me, so of course I walked up and touched one, and it turned on the light box. It kind of activated the video, and it just kind of gave me a passive viewing experience. But you know, that was kind of magical. It kind of captivated me. It captivated a lot of other people. Huge opportunity there with what you can do with that technology. What do I have on here? What's really cool to me in the future is mobile phones using these as remote controls. I mean, I think it's going to be amazing. The only thing that we can get there is to kind of reduce the pain that it takes to pair your device with an environment. And I think that's going to be huge moving forward. I think the panel before us in here was talking about, I won't say RFID,
sure.
But NFC capabilities. I think if anybody has an Apple TV, just the simple joy of controlling your Apple TV with the remote app is awesome. And if you can do that with real experience in the space and do it easily, and then give somebody the opportunity to kind of walk away from that experience and take something easily with them without having to download something, and you know, the pairing is huge. But then the opportunity to reconnect with that person elsewhere is huge. And to know, for a brand to know, if somebody engaged with them and is already paired with that brand, somebody shouldn't have to do it again. So if I engage with a brand somewhere at a restaurant in a table and kind of pay with my mobile phone device, and I'm kind of paired with that brand, I'm not paired with that table specifically. So I'd like to kind of see as we move forward, that experience, and of course I'm speaking lofty about it. But, yeah.
For me, I'm definitely interested in kind of what would classify as like the Internet of Things. You know, it seems like the Fuel Band has been a big hit this year. I saw some people unpacking it down the hallway there earlier. But you know, I have no experience actually with a Fuel Band or a Fitbit or any of those things. But everyone I know that you know. Really has nothing to do with exercise. They weren't really interested in it. Is really fascinated by these devices, and I think me personally, I'm fascinated like with Strava. I'm a road biker, and so I'm very involved in that scene. And it's actually really changed the way I know the way I look at the internet. It's kind of made me a little less jaded about it.
So tracking your activities.
Yeah, I think that idea. I'm going to say it, gamification. I hate that word.
You could say big data.
Yeah, like, I need the whole beer.
We only had 3 minutes left.
Yeah, does anybody have
any questions?
Yeah, sure. There's a mic up here, yeah.
So we have tactile touchscreens that are coming out probably within the next year or two. Are you guys looking forward to implementing anything using that technology? Where you can actually feel different surfaces on a screen, like sandpaper or kind of bubble wrap, and get that feedback.
I personally have never touched anything that simulates texture, but I think the haptic feedback is going to be huge, definitely. It's kind of a little magic.
Have you played with one? Have you been able to touch one?
They really haven't done it.
I know, yeah, that's kind of...
Yeah, they're doing it in some mobile phones as well, right? Nokia has some demos
that's
I've
pretty
seen.
Cool.
I've seen some amazing, cool like, just fabric sensory devices that are really cool, but... But I think we're all anxious to get to actually play with them, and you know, we're hoping that they kind of go pretty open source with them too. So,
yeah, can I say something before? I know people are filing out, but there's something I kind of wanted to say about technology and moving forward in the future. Something we all should watch is I know we're all trying to do new things and being so bleeding edge, but being too bleeding edge will cut you. It will. The technology itself we want to explore. And I'm only saying that in the sense of if we're working and using our clients' money to explore these, just be smart whenever we're employing new technologies because...
Earlier today I was sitting on a bench and a guy was playing a guitar on his iPad and I just wanted the analog device there. I didn't want someone playing a digital guitar.
Thank you.
Thanks.
To get advertisement personalized, face recognition is interesting. Do you have experience with that tool?
We do. Not face recognition in the sense of knowing the person. We've done face detection. I think it's a pretty big difference. I agree, that's a big thing with the Kinect SDK. Microsoft's going to come out with a face detection SDK soon. And there's already a lot of stuff out there that you can use. There's in the other building, I forget the product name, but they have a pretty compelling example of being able to detect people in space. I think that's a really valid. I didn't put that in my list, but definitely, if you know where somebody is using depth sensing, which is it's easy to find out where somebody's at, and then you can also know whose face goes with who. I think that's a pretty compelling. It's a whole new opens new opportunities. And it's been reliable for us. We haven't gone into face detection, face recognition. We've done detection because it's fast. Recognition is a bit slower, and so if you want like 30 frames per second, it can be tough to pull off.
Hi. You spend quite a bit of time at the beginning talking about how people are reticent to go and touch a touch screen and interact with something. And I just wondered how you sort of compare that with the sort of a traditional physical interactive exhibit, for example, and whether or not you know you have considered and or done exhibits where you actually combine both physical, you know, things, levers, wheels, whatever, and an output. Now, I understand that this is about touch screens and gestures, so perhaps that's off topic, but I think it's probably relevant to this conversation, right?
It is.
How you grab people.
Yeah, you can answer. You've done a lot.
We have done that, and there's the problem with that is there's... you have to harden it, so you get to a point where it has to be so hardened that it's not that fun anymore. But something that's happening is the little SIFTO cubes and the wide availability and the cheapness of these electronics through Spark Fund and organizations like that allows you to start making little tactile devices that you can use as input. That's the Internet of Things idea, and that's where we're going. We haven't done we're R&Ding on that, but that's more than we've also done like physical, like you know you have to pull it and push and stuff like that, but it breaks.
Yeah,
the problem is that it breaks. I mean, and so you end up making it so hardened that it's not really relevant anymore.
We've done quite a bit with Arduino sensors, and you know that is a great entry level kind of device that anyone can pretty much get into and be able to program and start testing some of these things. And I would agree that they're not always the most reliable, you know, thing over time. But for prototyping, they're amazing. So yeah.
We're being rushed.
Okay, so can you guys come up and see us after, right as soon as I close up, so that we can talk? So, everyone, thank you very much for staying until 6 o'clock.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
We had fun.
Thanks.
Enjoy your show.
Thank you.